Maximize cloud efficiency with Duit, the trusted partner in multi-cloud management for thousands of companies worldwide. Visit Duit.com. That's Duit.com. Duit, your cloud simplified.
One of the challenges we hear about when we are talking about running workloads in Kubernetes is that we would like to have lightweight applications that can be easy to pull down from the container registry to start up and kind of get things going. And if you have an application that is kind of heavy or maybe has some legacy in it, then the container images may become pretty big and it can become a challenge to run those efficiently on orchestrator systems like Kubernetes. That's where WebAssembly at some point really came into picture and kind of kicked a lot of talk and even hype in the community. And why is that? One of the strengths of WebAssembly is that it is delivered in a low-level binary format, kind of like assembler-like, and that results into some of the advantages of WebAssembly, which are its weight, size, and efficiency. But it's time to maybe use this opportunity to talk a little bit beyond the hype when it comes to WebAssembly. When does it make sense? Should everyone just go ahead and start building their applications with WebAssembly? And how does it fit in the whole Kubernetes ecosystem? And that is why today in this episode of Kubernetes Unpacked, myself and
Michael Levan.
Yeah, we have Matt Butcher with us today, who hopefully will help us see beyond the hype and hopefully make everyone a bit clearer on what WebAssembly is all about. Hello, Matt. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me on here. I'm looking forward to this. This is going to be fun.
Yeah. So Matt, I'll ask you the number one question. Is WASM going to get rid of Kubernetes and containers? Of course it is. No, we're just kidding. It's not.
Uh-oh. Let's just start lighting things on fire right here from the start.
Yes. I woke up and chose violence today.
Yeah.
But I mean, really, like, I know you saw it about a year or so ago, give or take. I saw it, Christina, you saw it. I mean, this was a major confusing piece to the cloud native puzzle. Everybody was like, does this mean Kubernetes is going to go away? Does this mean containers are going to go away?
Yeah.
And Matt, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this theory.
Probably the best place to start with that is just really quickly to say kind of why WebAssembly got me energized in the first place. You know, my background is cloud computing. I worked at HP Cloud when they were first starting getting into OpenStack. I made my way from there into Kubernetes very early. We built Helm, the package manager. I wrote the Children's Illustrated Guide to Kubernetes. This is the world in which I feel so comfortable and so passionate. And, you know, we were plowing along with virtual machines and containers, and we were very happy. But there were these problems that we were looking at that seemed to be sort of intractable in the container ecosystem, right? Serverless computing, and let me define that term because I hate the term serverless. I just can't find a better one, right? Serverless computing has been getting increasingly popular. Like 10 years or so ago, Amazon released Lambda. And Lambda was brilliant because it made it possible for them to basically spend their spare compute cycles on underutilized EC2 instances, you know, running single event handlers, basically. Something happened, it triggers your code, runs for milliseconds to seconds, maybe up into the minutes, and then it returns a response and shuts down. And that, you know, was a way for them to make an economical decision with their cloud. But for us as developers, it was like, oh, I kind of like this paradigm. It's very easy to write a single event handler instead of having to write an entire server. So when I think about serverless, what I'm thinking of is like the server that's missing is the software thing. We call it, you know, a server, a socket server, a thing that starts up and listens on a port and answers requests. And instead, when serverless functions, we're replacing that with an event handler that takes a request, does some crunching, and then sends back a response. So we're trying to figure out, you know, a couple of years ago, we're looking at this problem and going, how do we build like a really awesome, amazing sort of serverless developer experience, but put it inside of Kubernetes and with this like blazing fast performance so that we can really utilize, you're basically doing for Kubernetes what Amazon was trying to do for themselves. Mm. How do we really utilize those nodes to the max? And how do we utilize them in a way where when you get a burst of traffic, you can spin up a bunch of stuff, serverless functions, execute them, shut them back down in a couple of seconds, and not disrupt any of those long running containers that are doing their thing. And so we started looking around for technologies that would be useful for creating this sort of environment. And WebAssembly, which is kind of a funny technology to plug into a server, was actually the thing that bubbled up onto our radar, right? So WebAssembly originally is supposed to be a browser thing. It's supposed to let you run C++ code inside your web browser. Yeah, that's cool. Figma does it. Adobe does it. They've accomplished some amazing things on the browser side. But we're looking at that runtime. And we're going, it has all the things that we want in a cloud runtime. It's got a secure sandbox. It's got ultra fast startup times. The binary format's portable. So you can write and compile on Windows on an Intel architecture, deploy it onto Linux or BSD or anything on an ARM architecture, whatever. And the same piece of source code runs. And we looked at this and we were like, these are the virtues that we really want in this kind of third category of cloud compute runtime. So we got our VMs. They do their big burly thing. We got our containers. They do their long-running demonized process kind of thing. Now we're just looking for that runtime that can zoom in on the serverless style workload and give us an amazing experience there. To me, that's how I approach the whole thing. So what you didn't hear in that story is me lighting anything on fire and going, WebAssembly is going to destroy containers, because I don't think that's the case. I think what we're looking for is filling in a notable gap, right? Something that developers tell us they love. Amazon says they execute 1 trillion Lambda functions a month. So clearly people are liking this thing. And to be able to do that inside of Kubernetes, where your DevOps team, your platform engineering team can manage this alongside the regular pod workloads, this would be pretty awesome. So that's kind of where we got going when we started looking at WebAssembly as this kind of, you know, third class, third wave of cloud computing.
So this is the thing that I always try to wrap my head around as well. And by the way, for everybody that's listening, when we say WASM and WebAssembly, same thing, right? So if you're wondering if those are different verbiages, they are not. WebAssembly has been around for a while. Like, it's newer, but it's not super, super new. It's been around for a while.
Yeah.
Why do you think that now it's getting the visibility? Is it just that's the way the transition has gone? Is it because it's becoming more server-side available? Like, what do you think the reasoning is behind it popping now?
I think there's a funny way in which certain technologies seem to be built for one reason and kind of chug along for a while. And then suddenly, because of a totally different unanticipated reason, they go from fairly obscure to just like right in front of everybody. Like Ruby was a good example. I didn't realize that the Ruby language was started slightly before the Java programming language was started. So like in the 90s. Mm. And it sort of toiled along in obscurity as an alternative shell programming environment for a decade-ish. And then along comes like Basecamp and Ruby on Rails. And suddenly, you know, Ruby's found its use case. Mm. And I kind of think that that's the deal with WebAssembly. Like, they were solving a niche problem to get started with, right? How many of us really have looked at our, you know, our HTML and JavaScript and gone, you know what I'm missing here? Some C++, right? But there were cases where it's really necessary. I think Figma is an excellent example. You know, Figma, if you haven't used it, you know, it's a vector drawing in browser environment and it's amazing. Like, we use it internally for everything from wireframing and designing to I do my like mapping style planning kinds of stuff in there. And it runs really fast. And part of the reason why is because they wrote some core libraries, and I believe it was C++, compiled them to WebAssembly, and then they just hook into it with JavaScript. So there were some definite niches where it was working well, but it was not the kind of thing that seemed to have a really strong mainstream use case for a long time. Then, you know, the Bytecode Alliance, which is a sort of coalition of groups at Mozilla, Microsoft, Fermion, a whole bunch of companies like that, they started building a Rust-based WebAssembly runtime. Actually, they built a couple of them that were designed to run outside the browser and really highlight the sort of performance and security sandboxing environment. And that was just sort of like that little tiny tipping point that probably nobody noticed at the time. You know, a few dozen people notice it when it gets announced. But then the opportunities start to sit right in front of our eyes, right? Oh, I could take this thing and I could embed it in this environment and support multiple scripting languages, or I could plug it in over here. And suddenly people started to get more and more excited. And this is what drew, you know, me, for starters, right, is going, oh, now I've got an isolated WebAssembly runtime that I could just drop into a cloud environment and start building a really cool serverless runtime. And so we, so, you know, Fermion started in about 2021. We had been dabbling in WebAssembly for a year and a half before that, but we were watching this wave and we were watching it sort of happen. And, you know, having gone through this with containers before that, with virtual machines before that, I'm going, I see this pattern. I know this pattern. You get a bunch of really smart people going, hey, let's take this technology and repurpose it and see what it can do. And cool things happen. Right. And I think that's what we saw then. And then, as you've said, right, it's really kind of going on full steam ahead right now.
And this sounds really amazing. I mean, the examples you come up with, you know, running 3 trillions, maybe 3 already, I don't know, but 1 trillion like functions and being really performant. I mean, this sounds like a perfect technology for everyone. Yeah. But then at the same time, when you were telling us this story, you mentioned that this can run really nicely and not disrupt the existing container workloads or running side by side with pods, with regular pods. So I would like to follow up a bit on that. So do you mean that it's not a use case for every single application and not everything should run as WebAssembly? Or like, does it only make sense for the really large scale systems that have high performance as a requirement? And when is it a bad use case to go for WebAssembly, for example?
So a good way to start with this question is to zero in on one particular feature of WebAssembly that it has that virtual machines and containers don't have, right? So when we're talking about a virtual machine, the typical image size you're looking at starts at about, you know, for any normal virtual machine, starts at around 3 to 6 gig and kind of goes up from there. So they're slow to move around and they're slow to start up. They typically take minutes to start up a full virtual machine image. We all know this from, you know, adding a new node to a cluster and watching it spin up and get started, and we're waiting for it to come online. Containers manage to carve off a substantial amount of time in the startup process because they're sharing the kernel, they're sharing the drivers, and you're dealing with just kind of like a little pie-shaped wedge of an operating system instead of the whole operating system. And so a container can start in around the 12 to 25 seconds range. So, and that's a huge step forward. It's slow enough that you can't exactly scale on demand, right? Mm-hmm. You have to kind of do a little bit of modeling and you have to sort of pre-scale. So when Kubernetes came along, the way Kubernetes did this pre-scaling is they said, okay, well, you deploy a replica set, right? A deployment creates a replica set and you start up 3, 5, 7, 9, however many instances of this thing you need. And Kubernetes will keep those running. And if one node goes down, you still got 2 online. If you know, you trend on Hacker News and get blasted with 10,000 requests where you normally only get, you know, 100 requests, because you're already kind of scaled out, you're doing okay, and you can add an auto scaler and it'll slowly scale up. But what if you're trying to deal with a workload where it can scale all the way up to like tens of thousands of requests and all the way down to like 0 requests, right? What's called the scale to zero problem, where you really don't want to be running anything at all. That 12-second startup time for a container is still too slow. So again, going back to Lambda. So Amazon's looking at Lambda, you know, builds Lambda basically as a way to use their virtual machines that are sitting around and use them more effectively. We wanted to take that same kind of idea and explore doing that inside of Kubernetes and without the virtual machine part, right? We don't want to spin up a virtual machine for every function. In order for Amazon to do that, they have huge amounts of very costly infrastructure running under the hood. We wanted to get the same benefit, but faster than Lambda, better than Lambda, and in your Kubernetes node without really having very much to do or configure or anything like that. And WebAssembly's cold start time. So even now, you know, Lambda's cold start time, by the way, is 2 to 500 milliseconds. So we go from 12 seconds with a container to 200 to 500 milliseconds. Most of us are going, oh, that sounds great. Anybody who's a web developer is going, that sounds slow, right? Because we all know Google starts dinging you if it takes more than 100 milliseconds for your time to first byte. And if you're talking 200 to 500 milliseconds, that's still too slow for a high performance web app. But it's been fast enough for, again, Amazon to get trillions of invocations of these things per month for a variety of workloads. But when we started looking at WebAssembly, you know, our first foray, we were getting 10 millisecond cold startup time. So again, dropping an order of magnitude off of what Lambda could accomplish. Then we realized, well, we just hadn't turned on the right switches. And when we did that, we were down to a 1 millisecond cold startup time. At this point, it's under 1 millisecond because essentially you're just pushing down closer and closer to the speed it takes to invoke a native application, but inside the WebAssembly sandbox. So once we're looking at times like that, we're going, okay, here's the virtue of WebAssembly that the container ecosystem doesn't have. So it'll be great for those kinds of workloads that you want to start very fast, handle something and shut it down. But WebAssembly also has a weakness. It is not terribly good for running very long, IO-intensive, multi-threaded processes, which it happens to be the sweet spot for containers, right? If you're going to run a big, long-running individual server, a container is like the ideal way to encapsulate this, provide all the files, wire up all the file system handling, you know, and let it go and let it run for days, months, weeks, however long you want to run your pods, right? So what we saw was the sweet spot for WebAssembly was very fast startup, very short duration, you know, milliseconds to minutes, maybe hours kinds of invocation time. And the sweet spots for containers was really long running processes that might take a little while to get going, but we're going to be running for hours, days, weeks, months. And so, you know, again, going back to the setting everything on fire right from the top of the show, this is where we think containers and WebAssembly really work very well together because it allows you to combine that kind of serverless flow with your established or long running server based flow.
Let's take a quick sponsor break. Maximize cloud efficiency with Doit, the trusted partner in multi-cloud management for thousands of companies worldwide. Doit's innovative tools, expert insights, and smart technology make optimization simple. Elevate your cloud strategy and simplify your cloud spend. Visit doit.com. That's D-O-I-T.com. Doit, your cloud simplified. And now back to the show.
Let me ask you this, Matt. There were a couple of times where we're kind of talking about both Lambda and we're talking about Wasm. Is it fair to put Knative in the discussion as well? Or is it just so far off, or are there particular comparisons? Because of course, for myself, I'm sure for a lot of people, when we're thinking serverless and the whole idea of Lambda comes up, from a Kubernetes perspective, my head at least is always going towards like Knative, right? Are there similarities, or is it just in different leagues?
No, that's actually a great point. Knative is probably the right point of comparison for where Kubernetes has gotten until now, right? We've worked on multiple projects trying to figure out how to give that kind of serverless experience. And I think, you know, the differentiator here is, again, that that core technology was containers. And consequently, a large amount of the engineering went into figuring out how to build minimal container images or pre-warm things or keep things on hot standby. We sidestep that problem with WebAssembly because the cold start is fast, right? So if you're talking about a millisecond, there's no reason to pre-warm anything. A millisecond is so fast that other than ultra high performance computing, it's not going to be a time differentiator that makes a difference to someone. So, you know, you can kind of consider, like Black Friday is a great example of this, right? Where a shopping site may be kind of chugging along at the normal rate. And then, you know, about a week before Black Friday, the load starts to pick up. And then on one day, everything just spikes. And then the day after, things start to drop back down and then it eases back in. Mm-hmm. And Black Friday is not a great example because it's a predictable pattern. But we've all had those cases where, you know, something trended on Hacker News and suddenly you were dealing with 100 times the traffic, or something trended on social media and you were dealing with 1,000 times the traffic. And these were in unpredictable ways. That's where you want to be able to scale up instantly, right? To be able to handle the load right as it comes in. So the way that I've kind of articulated this, and I don't know, maybe this is pretentious, but you know, this is what CEOs are supposed to do. We come up with lingo so that we can, you know, sell you on the idea that we're super enthusiastic about. But I think of this as being sort of like serverless V2, right? Yeah. Serverless V1 was figuring out how to run with our existing compute patterns, you know, virtual machines and containers. And serverless V2 is really about saying, okay, now we have a runtime that's perfect for this kind of workload. How do we bring this one forward? But I think the Knative comparison there is very good, because I think what we're trying to do is take, you know, the best of the ideas from that kind of serverless V1 world and just make them so that the developer experience is easier, the performance is better, the operational experience is easier, and then bring forward something that will really, you know, truly solve a lot of these problems and drive the cost of computing down and the density that we can achieve up. Here's an example of density, for example. Kubernetes, you're limited to about 253. My IP math is getting bad here. About 253 pods per worker, right? And in order to get that on, you know, EKS, Amazon's version of Kubernetes, you're looking at running something like a 16x to a 32 extra large instance. So you're talking about a big, giant, beefy server in order to do that. And the reason you need one that big is simply because the container overhead is big. It's not huge, but it's big enough that you need a really beefy system in order to run that. Well, because WebAssembly is very lightweight, and because you're dealing with things that are starting and shutting down in milliseconds to seconds, maybe minutes, you don't need that level of capacity. So in Fermion Cloud, which is our, you know, developer tool for deploying your apps, we're running around 1600 apps per Amazon 2XL, right? Oh. So just this tiny little Amazon instance compared to the ones you normally use for loaded servers. We can run, you know, a couple orders of magnitude higher than what we'd normally be able to achieve in Kubernetes with containers. So that density story too is a really nice one, particularly now as suddenly we have to cut the costs of our cloud spend. I mean, for so long, we didn't have to worry about that. And now it's been kind of a downward pressure on us. Mm. You know, companies cutting budgets. How are you going to cut your cloud spend? Well, one way is to just increase the density. And a great way to do that is with, you know, by kind of taking the small, lightweight server-y apps and rewriting them as serverless apps and being able to deploy them in a way like this.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and I think you also get the kind of the other side that is also accelerating a lot, and that's about resource efficiency and utilization of the resources you have to their max potential. And that's what has been the strength of Kubernetes all along with compared to like regular VM deployments that, you get with containers, you get all the density. But now, like, here is also an example of how you could take that resource efficiency a step further.
Yep. And I think that's the story of cloud, right? Is where we started with basically leasing extra virtual machine capacity from the world's biggest bookstore and have turned it into this increasingly complicated ecosystem where what we're really after isn't so much paying somebody else to run our stuff, right? That was way back then. Now what we're trying to do is figure out what the best way to run sort of like distributed computing is, right? How do we make sure that reliability is ultra high, density is as high as we can get it, you know, resilience is high, security is high. And we're in a very different game than back then when it was like, yeah, I'm just going to upload my virtual machine and run it somewhere else. And so these incremental changes, you know, when applied judiciously, right? We don't want to rewrite everything from containers to WebAssembly, but we've got these workloads that we could run, rewrite and run in this kind of excellent way and reduce the amount we need to spend on those services and still keep allocated, you know, a decent resourcing for the big servers that always need to be on or the databases that we always want to have available. I always look at this as we're just making incremental steps. We're evolving as a cohort of developers, right? It's not a revolution every 3 years. It's an evolution step by step until we get farther and farther along this staircase we're building of distributed computing where we can run things in these like amazing configurations. And since multiple of us on this call have been on call for a while, the less on call time we have, the better, right? And so the more reliable and resilient we can build these systems to be, the more sleep we will get at night and the more time we will have for, you know, eating pizza and having a beer after work instead of, you know, logging in late to make sure everything is still online.
Automate yourself out of the job or in this sense, like make it so efficient that you don't need to do anything.
Exactly. The great thing about our industry is bugs will mean we're always employed forever in a day, right? But not having to be employed on a Friday night at 8 p.m. would be excellent, right?
or a Saturday morning at
3 a.m. or one of those. Yeah. As someone who spent a big swath of my career on call, I'm deeply empathetic to the buzz in the middle of the night where you're like, oh no, really?
Oh, nothing's worse than when it hits you like 5 minutes after you fall asleep and you wake up in that panic. And oh, what's going on?
You're like, even if I solve this problem in 15 minutes, I'm not getting any more sleep tonight, right?
Exactly. So, Matt, as we begin to wrap up here, what I want to ask you is, you know, what are your top maybe 1-2 tips for anybody that ultimately wants to break into WASM right now?
So Spin is an open source project, and you can find it on GitHub at github.com/fermion/spin. The goal of building this tool was to make it really, really easy to get started. In fact, our core user story for the entire first year Fermion was a company was, as a developer, I can go from blinking cursor to deployed application in 2 minutes or less. right? We were like, it should be that easy. And so we've worked hard to make that an easy experience. And then from there, you know, the doorway kind of opens from there, where you can try building your own serverless applications. As an open source project, there's all kinds of interesting areas where if you try this and you're enthusiastic about it, there's plenty of opportunity to jump in and help on anything from, you know, intro documentation through, you know, building core language support. One of the exciting things about WebAssembly, and this is an area where there's so much work to be done, but also so much has been done already. The way this works, you know, contrary to Docker, where you compile to your native format, you drop it in a Docker container and it runs. In WebAssembly, every language has to have a tool chain that produces WebAssembly artifacts. So for a compiled language like Rust or Go, you use the tool chain to build a WebAssembly binary instead of an ELF binary or an XE or whatever your local format is. For scripting languages, it's usually a little more sophisticated than that. Python, you know, basically has a Python WebAssembly interpreter and you just load your files like normal. But there's lots of upstream language work to be done. And it's a really fun thing to go and look at languages like Zig, which have, you know, it's new upcoming language with amazing WebAssembly support, or Grain, which is a language that was built specifically for WebAssembly. So if languages are your thing, there's so many interesting projects out there right now to look at, many of them really eager to find people involved, even if it's just kind of using and reporting back what your experiences were. And then in the Kubernetes ecosystem, you know, things are really kind of taken off right now. And I'm really looking forward to KubeCon coming up, because I think we're going to see all kinds of interesting use cases. If you were in KubeCon Chicago, you saw a whole bunch of talks about WebAssembly. We did the Children's Illustrated Guide to Kubernetes for WebAssembly last time around. It's catching on right now, and it's becoming that kind of thing where I think it'll be just another tool in the toolbox. I think one other thing I'd point out is, you know, as we all kind of start to find our feet in the AI world, I think WebAssembly has a lot to offer there. And this kind of serverless paradigm, when you're writing something that just runs an inference and shuts down instead of having to write an entire server to do chatty kinds of things, I think there's a lot of promise there as well. And we've been playing around with that quite a bit. And we've seen some really cool projects coming out of various places on that side. So that's another fun place to dive in.
Very cool.
Awesome. When you, I just need to pitch in one thing that I realized what I just read about. I was really fascinated when you mentioned programming languages, Matt. There is actually a new programming language out that is the namingless programming language. So it's basically avoids naming at all costs. You have no functions that you can define namings or anything. So maybe this can also be a use case to go and contribute, you know?
My ancient background is actually philosophy, and I studied logic a lot. And so, you know, unvariable logic is a really, really, now I need to know about this language, because this sounds
fun. Check it out, the namingless programming language. So if you want to see how we avoid our biggest challenge of naming.
Are we making this easier or harder to do? I'm not sure at this point. But fun, yes.
True that.
Oh. Awesome. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on. Really do appreciate it. I think this is going to be a very big thing in the Kubernetes space as a whole. I know you agree. And I'm pretty sure Christina agrees too. So I'm really excited to see where it goes. Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. This was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks, everyone.